You're listening to Face Off, Episode 5, recorded February 23rd, 2009. You're listening to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And today we'll be talking about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes at faceoffshow.com or follow us at Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow.
All right, Jade, last time we were talking a little bit about Doodle, and we have a little bit of correction to make, so why don't you refresh us on Doodle and tell us a little bit how it is.
All right, so Doodle is a web application that allows you to schedule meetings disregarding whatever calendaring program someone might be using. So you go in there, and as the meeting organizer, you kind of mark times that are okay for the meeting, and then you send a link out to everybody, and they can come back and select which times work for them, and then which times work for everybody. You can then, you know, schedule the meeting and send off the email.
Cool.
The one thing we got wrong is I said that what you do with Doodle is you put in all the attendees' emails and it sends the emails out for you. That is false.
So you actually send the link manually by yourself?
Yep. Yeah. After you schedule the meeting, then you just take it, gives you the link to send to everybody, and you paste it in your own email. This is better in more ways than one, because the first one I can think of is if Doodle did send the emails, if someone wasn't really familiar with it, they might, you know, look in their inbox and say, what is this Doodle thing sending me an email, you know, or, you know, and then mark it as junk, and then they'll never get Doodles again. So this way it is the actual attendee sending out the email to people, which is nice also because if they're using their own email application, then they probably have everybody's email addresses already in their contact list and all that stuff. So
yeah, I mean, with the spam these days, I mean, Doodle, if something like Doodle, the name Doodle, you know, it's like, what is this?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, name Doodle doesn't really tell you what the application does at all.
No, and things like, you know, there's some aggressive marketing type programs that, like, they'll ask you for your email password and then they'll start spamming out stuff. And I know I've gotten emails from, like, relatives and people that don't, you know, aren't aware of that kind of stuff. And so, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's...
So I think coming from your own email is a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, it actually worked out really well because it never did that in the first place. So,
yeah.
That's good.
And I see down here, it looks like they have a plugin for Outlook and stuff too. So maybe you can integrate a little.
Yeah, maybe. I haven't really played with it much because I think the standalone web application by itself is really cool and useful. So,
so it's pretty easy to use then?
Oh, super easy to use. It's cool. Great. So, all right, Mark. I guess we have a little correction about Snipped. Why don't you give us a refresher about Snipped and then what we found out later?
Sure. Snipped is, their tagline is long-term memory for coders. Snipped is a place where you can store little snippets or snips of code, little pieces of code for use later. And you can tag them, so you can have Bash, you can have Perl, Python, you know, whatever it is, and you can find it later by either search or your tags.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
So what did we get wrong about Snipped?
Well, I was wondering, you know, can we, like, let's say I wanted to share a little piece of code to you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just, you know, that I've already got in Snip that it's, yeah, that I usually use, can I share that to you? Can I link it to you?
Because you can, if I can interrupt you, you can make a Snip public.
Yeah, you can make a public Snip, yeah.
But then everyone can see it, and it comes in public searches and everything.
Right, and if I wanted to just show you something real quick, I could actually, there is a URL. They do have it. We were wrong. Last podcast, we didn't think they had it.
Mm-hmm. But so it's a private URL that comes with each little snip that is not, you know, it's not searchable by public people or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get this private URL and send it out to people that you want to see the snip without fear of it showing up in public searches or anything.
Right.
You don't log in to get it. It is a private URL that is open to anybody to see, but I'm assuming the title is hashed so that it's difficult to get.
Yeah, it's a huge long thing. There's no way you're going to brute force it or, like, just guess stuff randomly.
But that, and then you don't have to, like, share it with a username on Snipped. You can just give it to anybody. They don't have to log into Snipped, you know, because some people are really kind of, they really don't like logging,
they don't want
signing up
sign
for
up
new stuff.
Just to see a little tiny piece of code.
Although they should if they go to Snipped because it's pretty useful.
Pretty cool, yeah. And then they also, and to find the URL, you just look up the top. I mean, that's the URL that you would give out. It's got the hash in there already. But if you wanted to embed it on your site and you didn't have any syntax highlighting or something, they do have an embed link where you can use their JavaScript to do that for you, to make the code look nice.
That's awesome.
So you basically just tell what code it is into the thing. Basically, you just click on the link and hit copy and paste. But
wow,
what it, yeah.
So like, if I have a blog or like a forum software or something that doesn't support syntax highlighting,
yeah. Or if you don't have one already,
because like I know with WordPress by default you can create a, you know, can do pre-tags and stuff, which is monospaced font, which is great for code, but there's no highlighting or anything, so you have to use a plugin if you want syntax highlighting.
And not all blogs have one, or yeah, they have different ones or whatever. And so this always looks the same if you embed this.
Oh, that's very cool. So that embedding is handy. I think that's very cool.
So,
all right. So, Mark, I'm going to talk about some web apps. I got some good ones this week. I think you'll really like them. One of them, I know the first one I'm going to talk about, I know you're going to be really excited for, and it's called Social Thing. You can get to it at socialthing.com. And what Social Thing is it's a activity aggregator for various different social networks out on the internet.
Okay, so it's not, so ping.fm, you send updates, and this is the opposite of that? You get everything?
Yep, exactly. Okay. So with ping.fm, you know, you can send all your updates to Facebook, Twitter, and everything. With Social Thing, it grabs all of your friends' activity from these different things and puts it in the one place for you.
Okay.
Previously, the only thing I had found with this functionality was Flock, a web browser that kind of uses it, the fact that it's a web browser, to sneak in and grab your friends' information and display it to you. I think it just kind of scrapes it, you know, off the web. But Social Thing is a web application that does it, which is cool. I mean, Flock is cool, but at the same time, I don't want to replace my browser just for something that is a basic functionality to me.
Yeah, I would have a hard time replacing Firefox, even with a Flock's based off Firefox.
Yeah,
right?
It's got a Firefox backend.
Even if it is, I really don't want to give that up.
Especially if you're web developing, you just don't know what else it might do. Let's say you're trying to fix, let's say it does something a little bit weird that Firefox doesn't, you don't know, but you're spending hours debugging it, trying to figure out what the problem is, why isn't JavaScript doing the thing it should, when all along it could be your browser. I mean, I'm just nervous about replacing my browser for something as simple as getting a list of what my friends do on different social network websites.
Is Flock a Linux? Do they have a Linux version?
Yep. You can get on Linux, Mac, and Windows, which is cool.
That's a plus.
I'm kind of using it right now because I'm not doing much web development, and so it's fine for that, but I don't like replacing my browser for something like this that I should have thought, or that I thought should have been a web app. So this is it. I mean, I really would like to tell you a little bit more about it, but right now it's in a closed beta, and I don't have an invite. So,
But in a nutshell, it's like the opposite of ping.fm. Instead of sending out, you're receiving all the updates from all the different services, website.
From like this little screenshot I can see on it, someone is logged in and they're looking at their live stream, which is kind of what that is, you know, aggregates all your stuff in one stream. You can see that one of his friends has a Twitter update. Another friend posted a bunch of pictures to Picasa.
Is that Plurk, that green one?
That is Pounce, which is not there anymore. It used to be.
And it shows Dig too. That's cool.
Yeah, Flickr, your Digs, you know, your last.fm. So it looks like it has a lot of stuff already, which is really cool, because that's the other thing is, if it only did like Twitter and Pounce, then it would be useless.
I would really like to check this out. If anybody's got an invite, send it our way so we can do a real review on this.
Yeah, studio@faceoffshow.com. That would be really awesome, because I think this is what I've been looking for a long time. I can't remember if we talked about it on a podcast or if it was just a conversation that we had in general, but I think you and I both really wanted something like this.
Yeah, I wasn't serious about it, but I was thinking about making something like this.
Yeah.
My only concern is there going to be resistance to this? I mean, because you're taking the eyeballs and you're putting them on this website as opposed to Facebook and MySpace and Dig.
I mean, I definitely foresee there could be some pushback on this. But I think even if these companies start to push back against it, I think there's going to be a lot of pushback, and they're going to have to figure out a different strategy around it. I think a good example of this that's kind of currently hitting the news right now is Hulu.com recently cut off the applications Boxy and TV.com so that those things can't access their content anymore. And it's really kind of upsetting people because, I don't know why they did it. I don't think anybody really knows why they did it right now. But, once you start cutting it off, this is a useful application. I like Twitter is useful enough to me that I will go to Twitter every day.
Mm-hmm.
Plurk and Jaiku to me right now are not useful enough that I go to them every day. thanks to the usefulness of Ping, I can send out status updates to them, but I have no clue if anybody's commenting on my stuff or talking to me or anything on those, because it's just not useful enough for me to check it every, you know, hour every day.
Right. And one of my problems, one of my reasons for resisting new web apps is because I don't want to check 10 different things. I want one or two, you know.
Yeah.
With this, I could definitely check, I could use more apps. Less resistance for that.
Yeah. And so I think companies like, I think Twitter is a great example. To really get a good application like this, you have to use their APIs. It's really too difficult to scrape, you know? So I think what things like Twitter and stuff will do is when sites like this are taking eyes off their website, I think that they'll say, if you do, you know, over X amount of API calls a day, you're going to have to pay more for a premium version. You know, or pay a monthly fee for unlimited API calls.
Yeah, they could do that. Maybe they could work out a deal where they embed the ad or something, where they get a little bit or something.
Yeah, but I really hope there isn't resistance. But if there is, I think that they'll find that they'll have more resistance from their users for blocking things like this, because applications like this are super useful. And if you start blocking things like that, then all of a sudden you're telling your users what they can and can't do. And in today's sort of, you know, hip social generation, that doesn't fly.
I don't know. Let me know if you want to talk about this or not, but the Hulu thing, and this kind of relates, they're cutting off.
Yeah. So there's a really cool application out there called Boxy. I don't know if you've heard of it, but what it does is it kind of acts like a media center application for your computer, and it integrates a bunch of really easy to use web video and audio content. Like, you can listen to Streamcast radio stations on it, or Last.fm radio stations on it. Plus, you can watch, you used to be able to watch things like Hulu.com, MTV.com, Comedy Central videos on it. And it's a nice media center application, so you don't have to play with it.
Mm-hmm.
Really useful, because you can add friends to Boxy, and then you can see what your friends watch and then watch it too and stuff. But recently, Hulu, which was kind of one of the bigger content providers on something like Boxy, cut off outside video watching for it. They said, no, you're not going to do it anymore.
So that's and see, Boxy relates to this is because it's pulling all these different sources off. But here's the thing is, Hulu still has their ads. They're still making money by the eyeballs that are watching it through Boxy.
Yeah. Yeah. They have in-video ads as well as like pre-roll and post-roll, like before the video and after the video ads.
So this would be a little different because they basically take away all of Facebook's ads because they're all static images.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's weird that Hulu did this because they still were able... I mean, they can still sell ad time for their shows because,
right.
I mean, Boxy can't get rid of those. It's pulling the video from Hulu. It can't get rid of it. So I'm really curious to see what Hulu's doing, because they have to be doing something big or, you know, to really pull a move like this. So yep,
they're definitely up to something.
But I also see... I mean, there's been a lot of outcry about Hulu doing this, and people have kind of hacked their way around it to get Hulu back in Boxy.
Oh, have they?
Yeah, it's there's some really clever hacking going on. So I think, you know, companies like this, in today's world, it is not a good thing to tell your users what they can and can't do. I mean, we've seen this like Facebook terms of service debacle that just happened. When a company says they're going to change things and they're trying to tell their users what to do, today's social media, you know, hipsters don't like that, and we tend to fight back.
Yeah, so I mean, they kind of resisted there. I'm thinking maybe social networks might resist to this. I'm not sure.
I think so, but I think in the end things will.
Yeah, I think
things will reverse themselves. So.
I hope so.
Very cool. But anyway, Social Thing, check it out. Kind of bring it back. Social Thing's really cool. I'd love to check it out. So hopefully I can. Hopefully they'll open up the beta to more people soon, and we can get in and check it out, and maybe even talk about it more. I don't know.
Oh, I forgot to mention Nick from Lionburger, the creator of Snipped, sent us that tip about the direct link. Forgot to give him credit, so I want to do that.
Yeah, those Snipped guys are cool. They were really excited. So
didn't want to forget about that.
Which actually we'll hit on that later if you guys like that topic. We're gonna have a little bit discussion about that, but we've digressed.
Okay. So what do we got next?
All right, our next web app is Notify Me, which you can get to by going to notify.me. Clever cool. URL people.
Wonder what country or island that is.
Okay, so what's cool about Notify Me, so once you sign up for an account, what it does is it's an application that uses RSS to get sort of notifications. Anything from RSS, an item in RSS is a notification, and then deliver it to you the way you want in a bunch of different really cool ways. So the first thing you do is when you sign up, you add sources, which are just RSS feeds. That's all they are.
So you can, any RSS feed is going to work for.
Yeah, I mean, your Twitter RSS feed, your favorite news website RSS feed, you know, your blog RSS feed, my blog RSS feed, anything you want. That's fine.
Hmm.
So you add it, and it starts pulling these items out and kind of keeps track of them. But what's really cool about that then is you can change how those notifications get sent to you. So the first thing I added, there's three basic ways that you can get notifications, or four, my apologies. They do notifications over instant message, SMS, email, and their little notifyme.application.
What kind of IM protocols do they?
Jabber.
Okay.
Which you can use either your Jabber.
Or G-talk.
Actually, what you do is you have to connect to their Jabber server, which is kind of a pain. But let me get through this first. So what you can do with each one of your news sources, and this is where it's really awesome, is you can change which notification message you want for it. So when I sign up, they kind of give you big topic groups that they think you might like. So there's a couple like web development, web application ones out there that I signed up to, like the WordPress blogs is a good one. I love WordPress.
Okay.
So I look down here, and I have the WordPress development blog, which is a notification source I have. And currently right now I'm getting notifications via IM or the app. I don't have the app installed, but it's you know, enabled by default because they assume if you install the app, you want everything to be notified through the app.
Mm-hmm.
So all I have to do is, after I've entered in, you know, my text message information or my email address, is click SMS, and now I will get notifications about that feed via SMS. So it's really cool because you can kind of flexibly, you know, in a flexible way, decide how you want to get notified about RSS changes. And the IM one is really innovative. If you connect to their Jabber server and add their Jabber, you might not have to connect to their server. I apologize. I'm not really thinking about this. I can't remember right now.
It's all right.
You add their bot as a friend, and then whenever your feeds get updates that you've said you want IM updates for, it sends you an instant message with a link.
Cool. So if you don't want a text message or something every single time, you could have IM coming.
Yeah, exactly. And what's really cool about getting IM notifications is, let's say, you know, at work, I kind of, you know, at work, I want every distraction I can get, you know, because it's working for the man, right? So I connect to their service and add their IM bot, but at home I don't, because I don't want to be thinking, you know, my friends are instant messaging me every 10 minutes when there's, you know, a new news update or something, and run to my computer and find out it's just this.
Right.
But at work I'm at my computer all day, so I might as well get a distraction every once in a while when I can.
Yeah, and I mean, you're working with blogs and stuff at work all the time anyway, so the WordPress development, you know,
Well, that's work related, technically.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
You're not just goofing off or anything.
No,
like that.
No. No, that is what I do for a living.
Yeah, So that actually helps you do your blogging stuff better.
But here's a great example, right? You and I both subscribe to our comment feeds for our blog. Now, if I get a comment, I want to know about that right away.
Right.
So I'm going to set those feeds to SMS notification. So when I get a comment on my blog, I can fire it up and go, you know, tell this person, you know, answer their question or say thanks for commenting or things like that, right? So it's really cool for that, because you can kind of decide how you want to be notified about things. I mean, if you're already a big RSS reader person, it might not be as useful to you unless you have special cases that you want. But it's a pretty cool application. I'm really impressed with it.
Cool. And we're going to talk about this one a little bit more in our next in a topic later on about another RSS feed that would be awesome to use this service together with.
Yeah. So we'll hit on that. The only concern I kind of have with this is I kind of have a manual blackout time by not connecting to IM at work. But like, if you set up SMS notifications, I know a lot of people, I think took me off their SMS notification list on Twitter, cause I tend to tweet really late.
Uh-huh.
And on this, I don't see a way to sort of blackout chunks of time.
But it's a new app. They'll probably come out with something eventually.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a really easy feature.
Yeah,
to add.
That seems to be an easy thing to add.
You know, if their infrastructure, their core infrastructure and core competency is secure, that's a really quick thing that you can add later. So
sure,
that's really the only downfall I can see of it. But other than that, it's a really cool program.
You know what? I wonder if there's a feed on Twitter that has a blackout built in or something, and you could notify on that.
Ooh, I don't know if Twitter's RSS feeds don't black out. or blackout or not. I don't think they.
Maybe you could. I don't know. Maybe they have like a tag set up on their. I don't know.
We'll have to take a look at that later. All right. So let's. I'm going to move on to the next website. This one's a pretty cool one. I think you'll like it. It is called the Open Source Vulnerability Database, and you can get to it by going to osvdb.org.
All right.
All right. So what this is, Mark, is a giant sort of open source kind of, you know, Wikipedia-ish, wiki sort of database of software vulnerabilities.
Okay.
So I know you and I both subscribe to BugTrack.
Uh-huh.
Some people like Sukuna. I think you read Sukuna too, or yeah, there's a couple of other big names out there that look for vulnerabilities and then send you kind of an email digest. This does the same thing, except for it's not one company taking care of it. It's a community. You know, anybody can add vulnerabilities for any software.
And I know I'm a big fan of open source everything. I mean, you know, if we can get all the vulnerabilities in one database, it's open source. I'd rather have that than have to look at Sukuna and, you know, 10 other different companies.
Yeah, I mean, I know, like, organizations. You stuff. And I both subscribe to BugTrack because I find it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have everything out there,
no,
ever.
No.
So what this is nice is because it is a database, too. So it has, you know, all the vulnerabilities. But I guess, so let's talk about how you would use it. The first way is obviously you can search it, search for vulnerability. This is handy because what you find with, you find those with viruses, maybe not so much vulnerabilities, but every company has their own naming convention.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know.
Like BugTrack has their own.
Yeah.
Even though they're just basically an aggregation of all the other ones.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And there's Sukuna has theirs and Sans and.
Mm-hmm. So this is, I mean, this is a way to, if I search for one, you know, it'll have, I'm sure, at least the keyword from each of the different companies in that vulnerability. So I can make sure I get to the vulnerabilities I'm looking for. So if you go to the open source vulnerability database, it is kind of a mouthful to say. I don't know how people handle saying that, you know, five times fast. But you can browse vulnerabilities by disclosure date. I mean, they have vulnerabilities that are back to 1965.
Really?
Yeah. How crazy is that?
Give us an example. What can we find? Let's do WordPress. We love WordPress.
Okay, so let's do WordPress. So what I'm going to do at the top, I'm going to click vendors, and there's a big list of vendors up there. I'm going to go to W, and I'm going to have to go to page 2 of W. And all right, there is WordPress. All right, I click WordPress. And I've got all kinds of vulnerabilities. Well, actually, not all kinds. They're pretty good, WordPress. But there's vulnerabilities for all versions. There's a vulnerability for 1.5, 0.71, 2.0, 2.02, all kinds.
So that having this past information, that would be good to do statistics on certain apps with certain vulnerabilities or whatever.
That's yeah, cool. Or I mean, like a lot of bigger places tend to run older legacy applications just because they don't want to have to deal with vulnerabilities. So let's say you don't really want to go bleeding edge WordPress 2.7. I mean, mm-hmm. That's not even really bleeding edge, but it's their latest stable release. But let's say you know, you can look on here and you're like, okay, so 1.5 seems to be pretty patched up. You know, I don't want to have to train my users to use the new backend that WordPress has. So I can look at 1.5. It's pretty secure. I think I'll run with that.
Yeah, that's a good feature there.
Yeah. So
it looks like also they have a Mozilla search. So you could add that if you're doing a lot of vulnerability checking, you can add it right into your Firefox search bar.
Oh, that's really handy. That's cool. Yeah.
And the other thing that I noticed on here is it has a database. You can actually export the database to MySQL or SQLite.
Wow.
Or XML or whatever. So you could actually make an app that uses this database to search your own programs to see if there's vulnerabilities or do statistics or do anything.
Wow, that's really cool.
I mean, it's not just going to the site, searching for something, and finding vulnerabilities. They actually have their database that they are using that you can have. So that's cool.
It's not just open source in the sense that anyone can edit it. It's open source in that anyone can grab it and run with
it. This is the database. So that's cool.
The other really cool feature that I wanted to hit on really quick is if you create an account, you can watch certain vendors or products.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So let's see. Like, here's WordPress. This is a great example, right? I have an account, and I go, WordPress, I want to watch WordPress. I add it to my watch list. And now when I go to the website, I can go to my watch list. The only problem is if you can only watch 10 things before you have to pay for a subscription. Hmm. But that's good. I mean, I understand that. You know, you can't, you know, sometimes you wonder if maybe if Wikipedia did something like that, they wouldn't have huge ads up at the top every 2 months saying that they're about to go out of business, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I like this, though, because BugTrack gives you every vulnerability for apps yeah. that you don't even have.
Yeah.
So you're bombarded with all this information, which is great information, but it doesn't always pertain to what you're doing yeah. or your apps you have installed. So if you made a list with this, you could actually have, like, I have Apache, I have MySQL, yep. this version, and I got this. And
yeah, you can actually get vulnerabilities just for the software you need to pay attention for. This is really good at work because part of my job is they say I'm an application administrator. So, you know, like we're running Redmine, running WordPress multi-user, we're running, you know, PHP BB. And, I mean, right now I'm just, me personally, am kind of subscribed to their list. And I kind of watch their RSS feeds and stuff, but this would be a good way to do it all in one spot. And also you don't have to worry about, I mean, I don't, you like to think it's not out there, but you never know if a company is trying to hide a vulnerability or doesn't want to release it. This, I mean, anyone can enter this information in. So, I mean, how, that's really nice because, you know that a company kind of isn't trying to pull the wool over your eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there's a paid version. I wonder if they require you maybe to pay to get certain amount of downloads on the database.
I don't think so.
Don't think so?
No. I mean, I think it's just that they don't want you to watch like 200 things True. And use up all their bandwidth. I mean, most open source things, their thought is, we're trying to help you, but I mean, if you're going to be extra heavy on our system, you yeah. should have to pay for it.
Right, because I mean, they're doing it. You know, for basically nothing, they've got one Google ad here and a donate. So
yeah, and I can almost say I can guarantee you that they're not making money on this no, at I mean, all. It's just no, covering their costs.
But so it's open source, but I love that. So
yeah, so that's really cool. You know, you can add stuff to your watch list and watch it, and then you can, you know, subscribe to your watch list or anything like that. It's really useful. I suggest everyone take it.
This is cool. Nikto. You know, the web scanning.
Oh, yeah.
It
yeah.
scans for web vulnerabilities. It actually will come into this. It's supported. So.
Wow, really?
Yeah. And Snort, which is intrusion detection, mm-hmm. it gets updates from this. And the same with Nessus, which is an awesome scanner. So
wow.
They all come back to this open source database.
Very cool.
So I know I've used those tools in the past, and they're really great for finding old software. I mean, they're kind of scary. You're like, wow, I should update some stuff.
Yeah.
But so that's cool.
Yeah. So very cool. I suggest everyone check it out and at least watch, you know, big things that you're trying to watch, you know, vulnerabilities for. And, you know, if you can, contribute to this community, especially if you're a security specialist.
All right. What do we got next?
All right. The next little website, our next and last that I kind of want to talk about is called freesound.org. This is really cool because it is another database, another large database of Creative Commons sound clips.
Okay. So Creative Commons means we pretty much can use it anywhere.
Yeah, the whole point of again, correct me if I'm wrong, our listeners, because it does happen. I believe the whole point of Creative Commons being created was that people can copyright their work in a way that lets other people use it creatively in a flexible manner, but yet in a manner that can retain the rights of the original creator.
All right. So these are pretty high quality sounds, right? This isn't just...
Well, yeah, I mean, anyone could submit to it. So I think most people that are going to submit to it are probably creating high quality sounds or high quality recordings.
Okay.
But it's really cool. So, I mean, like an audio podcast such as ours, we're not making money on this, you know? So we can't really pay for a really large professional CD full of sound effects or something mm-hmm. if we want to put sound effects in there. Like here's a great example. I was looking for, you know, like the bell at the beginning of a boxing match because our show is called Face Off, and I thought it might be funny, you know, ding, ding, ding. So I found three different sound files on here.
Just by searching. Cool.
I searched for boxing bell and got three results. What's really cool about these sounds is, too, you can tag them so that...
So you can find them easier. Yeah. Other people can find them. So
the default title was like, I think, you know, ding bell dot wave, you know. That's not the great, but they tagged it, you know, boxing bell, ding, 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 mono. And because they tagged it that way, I was able to find it really easily.
Cool.
So, yeah, I mean, it's great for, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people out there doing podcasts like us that, you know, aren't big corporations that can't afford sounds. And so it's a great resource for people to go get sounds that they can use artistically in the way they want.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember researching for, like, doing screencasts. I was looking for, like, a little bit of, I don't know, tech noises or sounds or things. And I read an article about, you know, using music in podcasts, and you got to have podcast-safe music, because if you accidentally embed something that's copywritten and you didn't mean to or something, and you have to, like, go back and take those out of all your episodes that you already made, it could become
a or pay royalties, hassle. Which... Yeah. You know, you can't afford if you're just trying to run a little podcast yourself. So. Yeah,
especially if it's just a free thing that you enjoy doing. You're not out to make money.
Yeah, exactly. So that's cool. It's freesound.org. Check it out if you're looking for good audio clips. Okay, Mark. So let's get into some discussion topics.
Sure.
The first one I want to talk about, it's kind of a mix for of both a little tip for our users and then kind of a little discussion about how to properly use things like Twitter and stuff. So if you go to twitter.com, so let's go to twitter.com.
Okay.
So we run a podcast, and let's say, you know, I want to see something where anyone has said something about, you know, Face Off Show.
Okay.
So if you go to the very bottom of Twitter and you click search, it takes you to search.twitter.com. Which, okay, so I'm going to search for Face Off Show. And it comes up with all the results where someone had said Face Off Show, including even the fact it looks at the username and says, okay, Face Off Show is a username. Here are the tweets that user sent. Really cool. So you can kind of, you know, search Twitter, see what people are saying about anything, and look at the results. Here is the really cool tip. If you look on the upper right-hand side, there is an RSS feed, so you can subscribe to the RSS feed for your search query.
So if you're a business, or if you've got a Web 2.0 app, or even your blog, and you want to find out what people are saying about it, this would be a great thing to do. You could put your search query in here and then subscribe to your query.
Yep, and anytime someone says something about it, you know, it pops up as a new item in your RSS reader.
Yeah, I mean, and... Have you had experience with this? Have you?
Yeah, actually, how I kind of I figured out that people were doing this is because last week I was doing a webcast for work, and I was using Ustream, and Ustream, I think they just released kind of a new feature, and I think it was kind of taking a punch in the gut. It was not working at all. I was getting really frustrated with it, so I tweeted that Ustream was making me pull my hair out today. And 5 to 10 minutes later, I think it was, I got a tweet reply from someone working at Ustream saying, hey, what's the problem? What's going on?
Huh.
So
they're searching this.
Yeah. So, and it's nice because, I mean, you should be searching anyways, but this way you can search and then subscribe to your search feed. And you know, you're just, you know, you go into your RSS reader and, oh, hey, look, there you go. And someone tweeted about what your product is using. So, the discussion point, I mean, that's the tip. You can subscribe to your search feed. It's really cool. That way you can, you know, you can stay subscribed to what people are saying about you or your product on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, if you do find something, you can comment on it, and that person's going to feel like they're being taken care of.
Yeah, so that's kind of the thing I wanted to talk about is with services like this and sort of the huge user base of Twitter, you can really sort of close that corporate user gap. Right. I don't know about you, but a lot of times with bigger companies, I mean, you feel like a number in a queue. You don't feel like a user. You don't really feel like they care about you. But what's cool about this is, I mean, even if someone who works at, you know, like, let's say, you know, you work at Ustream, even though your username isn't, you know, Ustream or Ustream support, you just work at Ustream. You could subscribe to Ustream. And if you see someone, you know, said something about it, you can ask them about it, you know, as just, you know, part of doing your duty at work.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's really nice because it closes that gap. It makes you feel so much closer to that company because they're communicating to you in a way that you're familiar with that feels, you know, new and hip and cool, and it, you know, kind of gives them a face.
Yeah, I see in here we talked about Billing Boss? Yeah, Billing Boss, and they responded back that they're listening to us.
Yeah.
And they wanted to know what we thought about their product.
Yeah. So, I mean, it does a lot of really cool stuff. Like, I can see if, you know, I search for Face Off Show, I can see Face Off Show, the accounts, tweets. I can see that this guy named, whose username is Stay Blind, who's a guy that works at Snipped, I can see that he replied to, you know, to at Face Off Show because that's in the search query. I can see if, you know, let's say one of my friends, you know, tweeted, I'm listening to Face Off. I could see that if I searched for Face Off. So it's really cool. I think, I hope, you know, a lot of really young companies are doing this already, and I hope to see some of the old, you know, the old monolithic sort of big corporations. I really would like to see them start doing this too, because I think it really has an effect. I mean, it really changed my views of these companies. I mean, I really liked, you know, Snipped and Billing Boss and Mint anyways. But when I know that I can tweet them and possibly even get a reply, it makes me feel so much better about them. It's like they care all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, I had this experience. I wanted to do some suggestions on an open source project, and I made my suggestion. And immediately, within I think 5 minutes, they were the lead developer for that project. It was following me and asking me questions.
Yeah.
So it's really cool.
I think if anybody has a corporation or a service, or even, you know, like we talk about your personal brand, this is a way to do it. Like, I know, let's say I always forget to check my at replies on Twitter, because if I'm not subscribed to someone and they reply to me, it doesn't show up in my mainstream, and you have to go specifically to that section, at reply. I don't always do that. But this way, I mean, I can search for Jade Robbins as one word. I can search for just, you know, Jade and Robbins, and I can subscribe to this, and I can see in my RSS feeder, you know, it'll check that for me whether or not I have new replies.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great tip.
Yeah. So I think everybody, I mean, if you work, this is a great way to get, you know, some clout with your boss. You know, if you work for a company, subscribe to your company's, you know, Twitter feed and just, you know, reply to someone. You know, even if they say something good, reply back and say, hey, thank you. We're working really hard on this and I'm glad you like it, which is kind of the replies that we got. Or in this instance, you know, they were really good. They're like, hey, oh, just so you know, Snipped has private URLs.
Yeah, because we didn't know about that feature. So that makes Snipped that much better.
Oh, yeah, I can guarantee I'll recommend it. I mean, I probably would have anyways, but I mean, now I'll make sure I recommend it to anybody. Mm-hmm. If anyone sends me a Pastebin link, I'm going to say, no, throw it on Snipped.
Yep.
So I think everybody should do this, and I think it's a really cool tip. So check it out if you can.
Okay, next we have scaling web applications. I know this is an article that you found, and it seems to me like this is a great article because it was written by somebody that actually knows about the scaling. It was the Joe Stump, the lead architect from Dig, and he gave this presentation. And tell us about
well,
this.
Well, it was he gave this presentation at the Web 2.0 Expo, and he's the lead architect for Dig. And so this is, it's really cool. It's kind of someone took notes on his presentation. I haven't been able to find the actual video for this presentation, and it's not a transcript of it, but someone took really good notes, and there is some technical information in it, but there's also some really good just general information too, such as, you know, this is a great one. He said, scaling is specialization. When off-the-shelf solutions no longer work at a certain scale, you have to create systems that work for your particular need. So, I mean, that's a great tip. It's like, you know, some people, we kind of have gotten spoiled in the world of applications today and assume that there has to be an application to do whatever we want, you know? Mm-hmm. Let me install magic scaling app, you know, sudo apt-get magic scaling app, you know, and all of a sudden, hey, everything's scaled and it works. I can keep going and doing, you know, getting bigger.
And here's something that I saw. Languages don't scale. Making PHP 300% faster won't matter at all. Don't optimize PHP by using single versus double when the database is pegged.
Yeah.
And
the problem is a lot of applications, it's a good idea to be thinking about scaling from the beginning. I mean, we all like to think our app's going to blow up, but I think a lot of people, I mean, we've seen this with the Dig effect, right? I mean, how many blogs have you gone to, you see an article on Dig and you click on it and it's offline because they didn't think about scaling. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not on everyone's mind all the time. And the whole point of this is I think it should be in some capacity. If, you know, if you prepare something to blow up immediately from the beginning, when it does, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. And I see another tip here, a cache forever and then explicitly expire. I know YSlow, the Firefox extension, suggests to do the same thing. And that's another great plugin. If you're interested in the scalability stuff, is check out that extension, the YSlow.
Okay.
It's a Yahoo Firefox extension, and it will tell you, you know, you should do this or that, or, you know, you should set an expiration header, and you can actually get your page load to be like, you know, way, way fast, like 10 times faster.
Oh, wow.
Some websites.
Yeah.
Some of them are already pretty good. They already got a cache, but I mean, some people's websites are really not optimized.
Yeah. Well, because in today's world, anything can blow up. I mean, we all like to think that we're releasing good stuff to start with, but you never know. I mean, one little tiny web application that you make that you think is kind of a funny trinket might be huge tomorrow. And we saw this like with Twitter. Twitter, I mean, is still fairly stable these days, but when it was going down, I think it was last summer, there was it really, really blew up, and it was going down all the time. Twitter will never live that down. I mean, it's some people still think of Twitter as super unreliable just because it did that. And if they had prepared from the beginning to know that it was going to blow, to think that, you know, if it did blow up to X million users a day, then that never would have happened.
Mm-hmm. And it seems to be very stable now. Like you said, they're just getting that name because they had problems in the beginning.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed here on Dig, they've got 3 sysadmins, 2 DBAs, and 1 network admin, and only 15 coders. To me, for a site the size of Dig, that seems...
Yeah, I mean, it has 26 million unique visitors a month, 30 million users.
But it seems like only 15 coders, that seems like they should have 100.
Yeah, right. You know? I agree completely. And so this is a good thing of saying, if you do it right, if you prepare for scalability right, I mean, you don't have to spend a boatload of money on it.
Yeah, I mean, this is, if you've never checked this out, you should definitely read through this, skim it.
Yeah, the link will be in our show notes. It's kind of a long one. I don't really want to say it over the air, but it's really cool read. There is some technical information that most people can skim over, but if you do have, you know, maybe your own lead architect at your company, then maybe you should have them read that technical jargony stuff and learn something from it.
And check out Why Slow too if you're doing it for your own personal blog. Some of this stuff might be over the board if you're doing, you know, I mean, you're not making Dig. But some of this, I mean, Why Slow is a very good introduction to this stuff. I would say, like, so it actually will tell you how to do some of this stuff.
Oh, very cool.
Like, you know, an expires head, some of this cache stuff and set an expire. A lot of browsers, they've got a certain timeout by default. If you don't set it, and it's like 30 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Some of your content, as long as you don't change it, you could set it for a year.
Yeah.
And then what Yahoo suggests is use versioning.
Oh, okay.
So you have versions of your CSS files, and you just set expire forever.
Oh, okay. Like that. Oh, very cool. That's cool.
So the page, it's never reloading the CSS. It's always got a cache. As long as the person doesn't clear out their cache or cookies or whatever.
Yeah. So, okay, that's really cool.
So yeah, if you want an introduction to this stuff, check out Why Slow and then read this article.
Yeah, because, I mean, like you said, you know, let's say one of your blog articles goes big, and if it goes down, that's a lot of eyeballs that are going away from your page because they look at it. They're not going to go back. I mean, people, if it's not on the front page of Dig the next day, they're not going to go back and look at it. Mm-hmm. In fact, it'll probably get dug down.
Right.
Knowing that community.
Yeah. The dig effect is notorious for taking sites down.
Yeah. So, I mean, think of, you know, if you didn't even prepare for this. I mean, I know you and I use, you know, a WordPress plugin to cache our stuff for us. If you go down, you know, that's so many people that may have said, hey, this guy has great content. I want to subscribe to his blog. And then there's constant people reading your, you know. Uh-huh. So I think a lot of people need to think about it beforehand. You know, even if you're not doing it hardcore, you know, Dig full scalability to, you know, 26 million unique visitors a month, be prepared.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next thing is it's like a usability study, basically. It's how do users search for information on the internet? How do they scan the material, and how do they, are they satisfied with what they find, what they're finding, if they're finding it at all? And this study was done, it says, by Jacob Nielsen and John Marks in 97. And I know it mentions Sun in here. They're involved.
Okay. So, I mean, why is this useful to me?
Basically, this paper, they got a focus group of a bunch of users. They put it together, and they found that doing these 3 things, you can increase satisfaction and overall scannability, like searchability and people's preference on your site by like over 100%.
Wow.
So if you write, and we kind of know this, like a lot of people, a lot of the Dig articles that make front page are scannable, aggregations of like lists, top 10, mm-hmm. you know.
Oh, you see that on Digg all the time. Top 5 reasons. I mean, even if it's a simple article, it's like top 5 reasons why I'm awesome, and it's on the front page immediately. It was kind of a running joke for a while. It was like the top 10 ways to get your article to the front page of Digg.
Right.
And number 1 is always make a top, you know, a top X list of something, because that always gets to the front page immediately.
Since web users are used to clicking on hyperlinks, like they're reading an article and then they see, "Oh, I'm going to click here," and then they're off onto something else. Their attention spans are a little bit shorter because they're constantly changing what they're reading.
Yeah.
So
it's not a book.
It's not a book. It's not a newspaper where you got this article to read. You can click something and you're gone.
Yeah.
You're onto something different.
Yeah, you see this with Wikipedia all the time.
Yeah, Wikipedia is a great example. They've got, you know, you're reading an article and then you click on this link and boom, you're
the articles else. Always have a good table of contents with mm-hmm. set headers. There's links throughout the whole thing to link to another article. I mean, sometimes I'll look at something and
Wikipedia actually is, I don't read the entire article.
No.
And I know according to this study, a lot of other people don't read the whole article either. They're scanning the main headlines.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for bold words and they're looking at the links and then they click on them and go deeper into the topic they're searching.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
or even another topic that's not related. I mean, you see, there's like the Wikipedia 10 degrees of separation, mm-hmm. you know, where you can start at one topic and then you can stop at like PHP and then, you know, 20 minutes later of wasting time, you're on the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
You know, how does that work?
It's because it's so easy. It's not like you don't have to go on the bookshelf and grab another encyclopedia.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't need, you know, your click, bam, you're there.
You're like, oh, PHP is a processing language that runs it. And you're like, oh, it runs on Linux. Oh, Linux. Oh, okay. Whoa, Linux had started that long ago.
Yeah,
Linus Torvald. Oh, okay. Linus Torvald. Oh, okay. He was born in, you
know.
Yeah,
it's how far the rabbit hole goes.
Yeah, like it's an infinite rabbit.
Spiral, and fast. Like, yeah. You click, you're there. So knowing that the users can click and they have short attention spans because of it, they found that if you write in the concise way and it's a scannable document and it's in the objective writing style,
mm-hmm.
those are the three main things. You can actually effectively increase their satisfaction of that page, and you can make them find their information easier, and they will be more likely to come back to your site and use your information.
Yeah, I noticed another thing that this sort of study said too was to be really careful of comedy. You have to be mm-hmm. really cautious with it because, you know, there's people all over the world are going to be reading your content, and a lot of jokes don't translate over borders.
Definitely.
Languages.
Definitely.
Cultures. So, and I was really surprised to find that because I run MontanaFragFest.com, and I specifically wanted to design that site with, you know, comedic value in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
I thought that was interesting.
If your site is targeting, and the internet is a large, I mean, you have the whole world, you know, is on this one network.
It's a global community.
I mean, if your site is tailored, if it's tailored to a certain region, then you're probably okay to use the humor. But if you're trying to target to a mass audience, you got to be really careful with humor. It did say that the best humor to use was a cynical one because the most cultures are more likely to understand that type of humor versus mm-hmm. some of the other ones.
I did think it was funny too that one of the first things that this article said too was that it is definitely not written in the style that it recommends because it's supposed to be an academic document.
Yeah, this is an academic report. I mean, they cite everything, and mm-hmm. yeah, they're not trying to. If you are going to read this article, you probably should print it out and read it word for word.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if our users go to this link in the show notes, that they can't scan it to find the information that they want.
You're going to either have to listen to our summary and trust our word on it, or you're going to have to read the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, and then there's, credibility was a big thing. Linking to your sources
mm-hmm.
was a big thing. So like Wikipedia, when they're talking about something, they have a link to the thing that they're talking about in the paragraph or sentence that they're talking about.
Yeah, you don't want to go to a bibliography or
no.
You know, footnotes at the end because that's too long. That's too long for a short attention span. I mean, the whole point of the internet is supposed to be a hypertext document. I mean, HTML, hypertext, that it's dynamic and usable in a way that makes things fast.
Mm-hmm. So definitely check that out. It's worth a read. I think you're better off going there and reading it than taking our word for it, but...
Yeah,
but definitely. Trust me that it is one of the better articles I have ever written or read about this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So check this out.
Because, I mean, one of our objectives out there is to get people to our site and get content that is useful to them in a way that is useful to them.
If you're
going
to spend the time to make content and make information available, you better make it right and scannable and easy for them to read.
Yeah, and then you get on the front page of Dig, and you get a million viewers. And hopefully, if you scaled correctly, your website doesn't go down.
There you go. So our next topic... So
our next topic, it's just kind of an idea I thought, because I do write content for some websites, and the one thing I really don't like, and I think users don't like, is really generic titles for your content, right? So let's say on MontanaFragFest.com, I recently did a review of the web game Auditorium, but I didn't want to title it Web or Auditorium Review. But if I look at the search results that are coming to my page after people dig through, let's say, 8 pages of Google search results, they're getting to my link by searching for Auditorium Review. So I was thinking, how can I get more relevant information to that post without changing the title? Because I don't want a generic title. I don't want Auditorium Review to be my title. I think that's boring. Mm-hmm. So what I was thinking of is if, most applications out there these days have some sort of tagging. Mm-hmm. So I think... a good tip would be to look at your content, look at how people are getting to you, and then tag it for the way that they're searching it. So nowhere in my article do I say, this is a review of the game Auditorium. I say, Auditorium is an amazing experience of sound and visuals, but how do I get people, it is a review of the game Auditorium though. So what I did is I went in and I have millions of tags, web game, but then I tagged it Auditorium Review so that chunk of information is attached to that article without me generically, in a bland way, slapping it in my article. That makes it boring, in my opinion.
And you know that tag's going to work because you already have users searching for that exact keyword.
Yeah, exactly. And so more people searching for that will be able to find it because it now if officially has that chunk of, this is what this content is. And with... applications like WordPress, you can even tag creatively like that. You don't just have to tag it with one word stuff. You can tag it with a phrase.
Yeah. And you mentioned one way to do that would be to change the title, but you can't usually change the title because the title is often in the URL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For SEO, search engine optimization reasons, you would not want to change a title because then the user would, if anybody ever linked to you, you'd get a 30 or a 301, well, either a 404.
Yeah.
Which would be a page not found, or 301, which would be a redirect. Exactly. So you want to avoid that kind of stuff. So you don't want to change the URL. So a tag, using a tag would be a great way to add that value without changing the URL or anything.
Yeah, so. And without putting generic statements in your content. I mean, no one is searching for auditorium, beautiful sound, visual experience. Maybe one person is, but. What they're going to be looking for is reviews of the game Auditorium. So I think this is a great way to add that sort of extra value for both SEO and, user viewing.
Without changing the title something generic.
Yeah, without changing the title or fitting it with a bunch of generic content, which I think, I could do that. But then it's not as interesting of content. And the people I already have reading aren't going to want to read that. So I think that's a good tip. I mean, do you see any pitfalls with this? I know you're kind of the SEO guy. You think a lot about search engine optimization.
Yeah, I mean, like having the title in your UL is great. That adds SEO.
I agree.
You could even put the tag. I know I do category in there because, like, if I'm doing a Linux article, if I have Linux in the category, that's in the URL, which helps keywords.
If you have your permalink structure set that way.
Right. The only problem with that is if you accidentally post it in the wrong category, you should not change it because, well, I don't know if you should or shall or shouldn't change it, but if you do change it, you better put a 301 redirect so that Google, if they do link it, they'll find it. Otherwise, you're going to lose all your links for that. You're going to lose all your page rank for that page.
Yeah, and like so I know a great example, Montana Fragfest, the website I write for, I use multiple categories. So I have a reviews category, but I also like to tag it with the platform, like Xbox 360, PC, Wii, And I even set up my permalink structure to be /category/article name.
That's what I do.
But the only problem is then I don't know, I haven't figured out in WordPress how to set which category comes up in the URL. So there's been some articles.
If you do multiple categories.
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, if I do a review of an Xbox 360, an Xbox 360 game, sometimes it's slash Xbox 360 slash article title, not review, which I want review. I mean, I'm not concerned with 360, but I want that. Also, I want that category in there. So I think I think this is a little more elegant solution, and especially since, like you said, you cannot be changing that stuff after you've said it. You know, I mean, I'm not going to go after I've had a site that's been in production for a year. I'm not going to go change my permalink structure now.
No.
That would just be death.
Yeah. Not do that. What was I going to say about your? I lost my train of thought.
That's fine. We can move on to the next one.
Okay.
So this last topic I want to talk about real quick. It's something that I heard some things about, but I haven't, you know, really tried it. And it's called pair programming. Have you heard of this?
Just briefly, you told me about it just recently. So no, not really.
Okay. So what pair programming is instead of having two programmers working on separate projects at the same time, you take those two programmers and you make one programmer the driver who sits at the keyboard, and you make the other programmer work with him as a partner.
So one computer, two programmers.
Yep. And so I've never tried this myself, but what it's supposed to do is really give you some benefits. So for example, I know that when you code, a lot of times you kind of get into your coder tunnel vision as to how you're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just kind of keep going that way, hammering at it. But if you have someone else looking at it, I mean, that's a fresh set of eyes that's also working with you. They might say, I mean, I don't think that approach is the best way. What if we try this way? And then even then you can have a little discourse, you can discuss it, and hopefully the best solution will come out of it.
And I know another thing is, like, sometimes I'll be going and I'll get stuck on something and I'll debug it for a while, and then it drains your energy debugging something. You're frustrated and stuff. If you had two people, maybe you would have less of those types of problems, and maybe your productivity would be a little bit greater.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm just going to kind of buzz through the Wikipedia article on it. It says, here's some of the benefits that, you know, you get better design quality, you reduce the cost of development, and these are related to smaller number of bugs.
I like this as a scannable. It's got it's in italics and it's a nice.
Yeah, bolted. This so article is written perfect for our previous little discussion. I agree.
Okay, so continue.
Learning and training. You know, if you have two programmers working together, they can learn from each other. Maybe if you have one really inexperienced programmer, you can put him at the keyboard and have, you know, the other programmer be somewhat of a, you know, kind of a mentor while they're working on this project. You can overcome difficult problems easier because you have two people working on it and they can, you know, discuss it and come up with the best solution. You can improve morale because you're being social while you work, which programmers, I mean, that's a really big problem. I know when I'm programming, I'm usually in a hole by myself, and the only time I talk to people is when I have a problem. And am I, you know, doing this, you know, you and I kind of do this already through the internet. I mean, not really, but we're always talking about our projects and what we're working on and kind of just throwing stuff back and forth to each other. And it improves my morale. I mean, I like,
sure.
It really excites me that we're kind of working on the same thing. And and you know, there's a couple other small benefits, but
one of the drawbacks I see here is that you might have somebody that has a strong preference to doing something that you really hate, like a pet peeve.
Yeah.
Somebody might use a certain shortcut that you just can't stand because for whatever reason. I can see those types of things getting in the way, but yeah. At the same time, I see the benefits over, you know, I could see the benefits of this.
Yeah, I mean, all the drawbacks are pretty much related to personality, yeah. and preferences.
I could see this really working in a training environment, put like an apprenticeship style, like I'm a very good Ruby programmer or something, and you're not.
Mm-hmm.
So you sit here, and I'm going to watch you code, and I'm going to give you tips.
Yeah.
It might get a little overwhelming for a new person, but overall, I think that would work really well.
Well, one of the hardest things, I think, when you're learning a language or learning something new is that you fall into sort of, you know, traps of things that happen all the time, where if you have an experienced programmer sitting there with you, they've gone through all of that, you know?
Yeah, so you're going to learn way faster.
Yeah, and I know, I think you've ran into this. I think every programmer has ran into this, where you do it the way you think, you know, and then you try and run the program, and it's not working. So you spend 3 hours debugging it, tweaking it, to the point of that it's not even anywhere near the way you originally envisioned it. And then finally you give up and you say, fine, I need a fresh pair of eyes on this. And you ask your friend to take a peek at it, and they find, you know, within 2 seconds that you forgot to put a parenthesis.
Yeah. And exactly.
I mean, think of all that time saved. That's a great sort of use case for this, because all that time spent working on it and then debugging it and redeveloping it could have been fixed if that person was sitting with them at that one point when they program and they say, oh, hey, you forgot that parenthesis right there. Oh, hey, you misspelled that variable name right there.
Mm-hmm. And I actually, on that note, I mean, they say that I'm looking at the studies that they've already done, and some of the studies found that it's higher quality code. There's less bugs. And if you find a bug later on in the development cycle, it's much more expensive and more time consuming to find that bug and get rid of it versus if you find it right away when you're both programming. One of the studies found that there was 84% increase in effort. So that was very surprising.
Wow. Yeah. That's really cool.
And the only other thing I wanted to talk about with the pair programming is you can do remote. Some people, they actually have some IDEs that are built in, that have built-in pair programming features like collaborative real-time editor. NetBeans is one that supports that. So like a Google Doc, you could be both collaborating on it online.
Oh, wow. And then, I mean, it may be connected like with Skype and you can talk about it. And
yeah.
That's really cool. That would
eliminate a little bit of the pet peeves and some of the...
Yeah.
Because you're, you know...
If you didn't have to hear someone, you know...
A little bit.
Yeah.
But it might not be as effective.
I don't think it'd be as effective. I mean, it's one of those things that if you work in a culture that you don't think will support this, it probably won't happen. This kind of seems, I look at this now, and it seems to me like it's kind of, we talked about blogs and wikis in the workplace. It sounds like a hard sell. I mean, it's one of those things that the benefits of it don't stick out really bright. You know, you can't really easily say that because these guys were pair programming, they were 80% more effective, they had less bugs. You know, you kind of, people expect you to write software with no bugs anyways, mm-hmm. for some reason. So I think it's one of those things that it's really hard to sell. And once you do, I think you'll see benefits right away, especially the people who are actually doing it. You know, it's hard to sell to a boss that you need to have your employees take an hour, let's say, out of each day to write on a blog. You know, that's a hard sell because they say, well, they're not working for that hour. And what does that get me? But that, I mean, it's one of the, I think that if you have people pair programming, that you will find that it'll work a lot better once you actually do it. That is, if you have a culture that would support it. I mean, if you're kind of maybe in a company with older people who, you know, aren't trying to find innovative new ways to do it, you're probably not going to be able to implement it.
Yeah, I would really be interested in doing this with you, at least for an hour on some random project, just to see what it would be like.
If any of our listeners have any experience actually doing this, or you know, maybe know of someone who did and kind of have some outcomes of something, I'd love to hear from them. If they could email us or tweet us or something, that would be great.
Or send an audio recording. We'll play it on the show, if you know.
Yeah, because I'm really would like to hear some. I mean, you know, you can read a Wikipedia article all you want, but I really want to hear someone who did this and what they think about it.
Sure.
So. I think it's a really cool concept. I think you and I should try it sometime, and we can maybe report back as to what we find.
Sure.
So, all right. Well, that about wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. And we want to remind you guys that you can subscribe to our podcast at faceoffshow.com/feed. If you have a suggestion or comment, you can email studio@faceoffshow.com. You can reply to us at Twitter at twitter.com/faceoffshow. Or you can just leave a comment on our blog at faceoffshow.com. So, I mean, we'd love to hear from anybody out there that has any suggestions or ideas. We're always welcoming them.